This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of 2 Kings. Now, here's Pastor Sandy as he teaches through 2 Kings chapters 15 through 17.
You remember, Jeroboam was the first of Israel's kings. And this man left a sad legacy that Israel was never able to overcome. You remember what his sin was? Jeroboam's sin was a subtle form of idolatry. You see, he didn't want his people going down to Jerusalem to the temple to worship there. If they did, he felt like that they would gravitate back to Judah, and therefore, you know, they wouldn't remain in his northern kingdom that he had broken off from Judah. And so he came up with an alternative religion. He erected golden calves in Dan and in Bethel. And understand, in his mind, these were not replacements for God. These were representations of God. Perhaps they were the living creatures in heaven. They were a form of idolatry. They were graven images. They were representations of God. In essence, the sin of Jeroboam was not so much a violation of the first commandment, thou shalt have no other gods. It was a violation of the second commandment, that you can't worship God through carved or graven images. The problem, though, is that a violation of the second commandment most often will lead to a violation of the first. Jeroboam, he worshiped God, but not in the way that God desired to be worshiped. Jeroboam's religion was his own invention, one that was convenient, but one that was not faithful. And sadly, all 19 of his predecessors, or 18 of his predecessors, they followed in his footsteps. They promoted the sin of Jeroboam. And in the end, the corrupt worship of Jeroboam was the primary reason that God judged the northern kingdom of Israel. What's the lesson for us? Let's make sure we worship God in the way he wants to be worshiped, not just in the way that's convenient for us. Let's make sure that our worship obeys God, not just appeases me. Well, verse 29 tells us, in the days of Pekah, king of Israel, Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, came and took Eon, Abel-Beth-Maacah, Genoa, Kedesh, Hazar, Gilead, and Galilee, all the land of Naphtali, and he carried them captive to Assyria. The Assyrians attacked the border towns, and they took their inhabitants prisoner. And it was the beginning of the end for this northern kingdom of Israel. Then Hoshea, the son of Elah, led a conspiracy against Pekah, the son of Remaliah, and struck him and killed him. So he reigned in his place in the 20th year of Jotham, the son of Uzziah. Now the rest of the acts of Pekah and all that he did, indeed, they are written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel. Hoshea will reign 9 more years, but he is the last of Israel's kings. Now in Judah, the death of Uzziah was followed by the reign of his son, Jotham. Jotham, too, was a good and godly king. He reigned 16 years in Jerusalem. But notice the reoccurring problem for Jotham. 2 Kings 15, verse 35 reads, however, the high places were not removed. And this is the omission that eventually bites Judah and this king Jotham. The rest of the chapter takes us south to the reign of Jotham, Uzziah's successor, verse 32. In the second year of Pekah, the son of Remaliah, the king of Israel, Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah, began to reign. He was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Jerusha. And on Mother's Day, isn't it great to see these mothers mentioned here in the scriptures? The daughter of Zadok, and he did what was right in the sight of the Lord. He did according to all that his father Uzziah had done. All these other guys who were evil, their mothers never get mentioned. Apparently they weren't doing a very good job. But the good kings, they get their mothers mentioned. However, the high places were not removed. The people still sacrificed and burned incense on the high places. He built the upper gate of the house of the Lord. These high places were altars where idolatry could be practiced. Not necessarily where it was practiced, but where it could be practiced. You see, God centralized worship among his people. Everyone was required to worship at the temple. This is why the sin of Jeroboam was so diabolical, because Jeroboam refused to let the people of the north go south to worship at the temple. He kept them within their confines and invented this false religion for them. But God's plan was for everyone to go to Jerusalem and to worship together. You were not supposed to erect your own altar or your own high place, an elevated platform that would perhaps hold an idol. These were outlawed. Worship was to remain pure. And yet, even when the Jews went to the temple, they still liked to hold on to their high places, their little private altars. They didn't bow to the idol necessarily, but for some reason, they always liked to polish the idol's pedestal. And I think there's an equivalent in our lives. It happens subtly. Though I promise God that I'm going to serve him, though I promise God he's the only one to whom I'm going to give my life and my allegiance, nevertheless, I tend to want to leave some options open. Oh, I want to follow God, but I don't necessarily want to burn my contacts with the world. I don't want to cut off my supply lines to sin. I want to kind of keep sin within reach, just in case I want to go back at some point. In other words, I've taken down my idol, but oh my, I'm still maintaining my pedestal. I've gotten rid of the idols, but I still am holding on to the high places. It's a sin that eventually leads to compromise. And that's why God says, get rid of the high places. Now, the rest of the acts of Jotham and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? In those days, the Lord began to send Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, against Judah. So Jotham rested with his fathers and was buried with his fathers in the city of David, his father. Then Ahaz, his son, reigned in his place. Chapter 16. Now in the 17th year of Pekah, the son of Remaliah, Ahaz, the son of Jotham, king of Judah, began to reign. Ahaz was 20 years old when he became king, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem. And he did not do what was right in the sight of the Lord his God, as his father David had done. But he walked in the way of the kings of Israel. Indeed, he made his son pass through the fire according to the abominations of the nations whom the Lord had cast out from before the children of Israel. You see, his father's high places yielded to his full-blown idolatry. Ahaz forsook Jehovah God, and he worshiped Molech, the king of the Moabites. And one of the practices, you remember, of the worship of Molech was the sacrifice of their children. Child sacrifice was a big part of it, making your sons pass through the fire. You see, Molech was a hollowed-out statue, a statue of brass, and they would stoke it with fire, and the arms of the statue would be held out like this, and they would lay their babies into the arms of Molech, and they would literally burn to death as they were worshiping and chanting and all to Molech. These were the sins, remember, for which God judged the Canaanites, the original possessors of the land. And now Israel is proving that she has stooped just as low as those Canaanites. And now Israel is being judged. And he sacrificed and burned incense on the high places, on the hills, and under every green tree. Again, notice, one generation's compromise morphs into the second generation's outright idolatry. Be careful what you tolerate. Your little compromises are permission for your child to travel the same path, yet your child will always go further. Your social drinking could become your teenager's excuse to go off on a binge. I'm just saying, whatever path you travel down, expect your teenager to travel that same path, yet go further. Verse 5. Then Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, came up to Jerusalem to make war. King Ahaz's two northern neighbors team up to pick on Judah. And they besieged Ahaz, but could not overcome him. At that time, Rezin, king of Syria, captured Elath for Syria and drove the men of Judah from Elath Then the Edomites went to Eloth and dwelt there to this day. So Ahaz sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, saying, I am your servant and your son. Come up and save me from the hand of the king of Syria and from the hand of the king of Israel, who will rise up against me. Now this was a terrible mistake. Rather than trust the Lord, Ahaz buys the Assyrians' protection. Between Judah and the Assyrians are two other kingdoms, Israel and Syria. These two kingdoms are now picking on Judah. And so what does Judah do? King Ahaz sends word to Tiglath-Pileser, won't you come and help me? Ahaz took the silver and the gold that was found in the house of the Lord and in the treasuries of the king's house and sent it as a present to the king of Assyria. What an insult to God. Not only does Ahaz refuse to trust the Lord, he buys the Assyrian protection with treasures that have been dedicated to God. It was like pouring salt in a wound. And so the king of Assyria heeded him, for the king of Assyria went up against Damascus, which was the capital of Syria, and took it, carried its people captive to Kir, and killed Rezin. Now I'm sure Ahaz loved the initial results. The capital of Syria, Damascus, fell to the Assyrians in 732 BC. But understand, this was like inviting a serial killer into your house to protect you from your neighbor. It was. It's only a matter of time before he turns on you next. At first, Assyria fights for Judah. By the time we get to chapter 18, Assyria is fighting against Judah. Verse 10. Now King Ahaz went to Damascus to meet Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria. And he saw an altar that was at Damascus. And King Ahaz went to Uriah the priest, sent to Uriah the priest the design of the altar in its pattern according to all its workmanship. Then Uriah the priest built an altar according to all that King Ahaz had sent from Damascus. So Uriah the priest made it before King Ahaz came from Damascus. And when the king came from Damascus, the king saw the altar, and the king approached the altar and made offerings on it. And so he burned his burnt offering and his grain offering, and he poured his drink offering and sprinkled the blood of his peace offerings on the altar. He also brought the bronze altar, which was before the Lord, from the front of the temple, from between the new altar and the house of the Lord, and put it on the north side of the new altar. Now it's unclear as to whether Ahaz did all this in the name of the Assyrian gods, or whether he just worshiped Jehovah God in Assyrian style. You know, he just kind of created this Assyrian-like altar that kind of reflected this wonderful altar he had seen there in Damascus. But I think there's a parallel here. Here Ahaz worships Jehovah in Assyrian style. And how much worship goes on in the church today, how much of it is being done in the style of the world? This is what some Christians have done by merging some pagan practices in with Christian living. I'm weary today of what's being called relaxation techniques. Things like yoga and visualization and chanting your mantra. You know, these go by relaxation, but in reality, these are forms of Eastern mysticism. Today, yoga has become a fashionable form of exercise. Even some churches have jumped on the bandwagon, somehow ignoring that the ancient practice of yoga is inextricably linked to Hinduism. The term Christian yoga is an oxymoron. I read of one group that calls itself Yahweh Yoga. They've got chapters in different Christian churches. That sounds like a name coined by King Ahaz. You see, Ahaz Assyrianized his altar. He sort of jazzed it up with pagan elements. He adopted the values and the forms of the Assyrian worship to make his altar more fashionable. Oh, people will be able to relate to this. I'm afraid that's what's happening in many quarters of the church. If you want to exercise, if you want to stretch, if you want to pray while you're doing it, go for it, fine. But you certainly shouldn't employ yoga. I believe this whole idea of Christian yoga is certainly a stretch. Any amalgamation of Christianity and paganism is certainly an affront to God. Well, verse 15 tells us, "Then King Ahaz commanded Uriah the priest, saying, 'On the great new altar burn the morning burnt offering, the evening grain offering, the king's burnt offering and his grain offering, with the burnt offering of all the people of the land, their grain offering and their drink offerings, and sprinkle it all the blood of the burnt offering and all the blood of the sacrifice. And the bronze altar shall be for me to inquire by.'" In other words, to seek God's will. He'd go back to the original altar to seek God's will. This other altar, though, this would be great. This would get the people in, you know. They'd all be excited about this Assyrianized altar. "Well, thus did Uriah the priest, according to all that King Ahaz commanded. And King Ahaz cut off the panels of the carts and removed the lavers from them. And he took down the sieve from the bronze oxen that were under it, and he put it on pavement stones." He makes all these alterations to the temple there in Jerusalem. "And also he removed the Sabbath pavilion which they had built in the temple. And he removed the king's outer entrance from the house of the Lord on account of the king of Assyria." Ahaz tailored the temple to conform to Assyrian tastes. King Ahaz wanted to please the Assyrians more than he wanted to please God. "And now the rest of the acts of Ahaz which he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? And so Ahaz rested with his fathers," of course another name, another way of saying he died, "and was buried with his fathers in the city of David. Then Hezekiah, his son, reigned in his place." Now chapter 17 records the siege and fall of Israel and her capital city, Samaria. Here's a name for you: Shalmaneser the Fifth. This is the son of Pul, or Tiglath-Pileser. He's now king of Assyria, and he is the commander of the Assyrian army. Haley's Bible Handbook comments on Nineveh's army. Listen to this. "The Assyrians were great warriors. Most nations then were robber nations. The Assyrians seem to have been about the worst of them all. They built their state on the loot of other peoples. They practiced cruelty. They skinned their prisoners alive, or cut off their hands, feet, noses, ears, or put out their eyes, or pulled out their tongues, and made mounds of human skulls, all to inspire terror. When they conquered a city, they would pile skulls out in front of the gate just to intimidate the crowds that might pass by. These vicious people besieged Samaria for 3 years, sucking the very life out of her until the city was finally destroyed." But chapter 17 makes it clear that the fall of the northern kingdom was not the result of Assyrian might, nor was it the result of Israel's military weakness. In Isaiah chapter 10, verse 5, God refers to the Assyrians as the rod of my anger and the staff in whose hand is my indignation. You see, the Assyrians were a tool of God's judgment. Verse 1. "In the 12th year of Ahaz, king of Judah, Hoshea, the son of Elah, became king of Israel in Samaria, and he reigned 9 years. And he did evil in the sight of the Lord, but not as the kings of Israel who were before him. Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came up against him, and Hoshea became his vassal and paid him tribute. And the king of Assyria uncovered a conspiracy by Hoshea, for he had sent messengers to So, king of Egypt, and brought no tribute to the king of Assyria as he had done year by year. Therefore, the king of Assyria shut him up and bound him in prison. Now the king of Assyria went throughout all the land and went up to Samaria and besieged it for 3 years." Siege warfare was an ancient art of battle. You cut off a city's supply lines, you waited until they either starved to death or they surrendered. This final attack was brought on by Hoshea's conspiracy. He tried to recruit the Egyptians' help. Well, in the 9th year of Hoshea, 722, the infamous secular date, the king of Assyria took Samaria and carried Israel away to Assyria and placed them in Halah and by the Habar, the river of Gozan, and in the cities of the Medes. You see, the Assyrian policy toward conquered people was one of displacement. Later, we'll see that the Babylonians, they would take their enemy back to Babel, back to Babylon with them. But the Assyrians, they would scatter their defeated foes into other parts of the empire. We're told, for so it was that the children of Israel had sinned against the Lord their God, who had brought them up out of the land of Egypt from under the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And they had feared other gods and had walked in the statutes of the nations whom the Lord has cast out from before the children of Israel and of the kings of Israel, which they had made. Their crimes were quite clear. The northern tribes had sinned against God and had followed pagan practices. Also, the children of Israel secretly did against the Lord their God things that were not right. And they built for themselves high places in all their cities, from watchtower to fortified city. They set up for themselves sacred pillars and wooden images on every high hill and under every green tree. Some of these wooden images were phallic symbols that were used in the worship of the Canaanite fertility goddesses. They were burned incense on all the high places, like the nations whom the Lord had carried away before them. Israel literally became worse than the Canaanites who had preceded them, whom God had used for them to judge. They mimicked the sins of their predecessors. And they did wicked things to provoke the Lord to anger, for they served idols of which the Lord had said to them, "You shall not do this thing." Yet the Lord testified against Israel and against Judah by all of his prophets, every seer, saying, "Turn from your evil ways and keep my commandments and my statutes according to all that the law which I commanded your fathers and which I sent you by my servants, the prophets." God sent prophets to warn them. Nevertheless, they would not hear, but stiffed their necks like the necks of their fathers who did not believe in the Lord their God. They grew stubborn. They refused to listen. And they rejected his statutes and his covenant that he had made with their fathers and his testimonies which he had testified against them. They followed idols, became idolaters, and went after the nations who were all around them, concerning whom the Lord had charged them that they should not do like them. So they left all the commandments of the Lord their God, made for themselves a molded image and two calves, again, the sin of Jeroboam, made a wooden image and worshipped all the host of heaven and served Baal. And they caused their sons and daughters to pass through the fire, practiced witchcraft and soothsaying, and sold themselves to do evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger. Therefore the Lord was very angry with Israel and removed them from his sight. There was none left but the tribe of Judah alone. The northern kingdom was taken captive and dispersed. The southern kingdom of Judah was all that remained. And also Judah did not keep the commandments of the Lord their God, but walked in the statutes of Israel, which they made. Because of Judah's 8 good kings, God still had hope for Judah. And Judah is given another 120 years to repent. The Lord rejected all the descendants of Israel, afflicted them, and delivered them into the hand of plunderers until he had cast them from his sight. For he tore Israel from the house of David, and they made Jeroboam the son of Nebat king. Then Jeroboam drove Israel from following the Lord and made them commit a great sin. Once again, a reference to the sin of Jeroboam. This was a big deal in the sight of God. God desires to be worshipped in a prescribed and in a specific manner. He doesn't leave it up to us to decide how to worship him, as if we can tailor that worship to our own tastes, as if we can worship him in ways that are convenient for us. No, God wants to be worshipped in the way he desires, not just in the way that's easy for us.
Being on the go is something we're all accustomed to in this culture. The hustle and bustle of life seems to make the days just fly by. For most of us, our smartphones are sort of an extension of our bodies, constantly ringing and dinging, telling us where to be and what the next appointment is. The technology that we enjoy in this day and age is amazing. And while there's certainly no end to the bad things we can find online and through our smartphones, there's also some great kingdom-minded options. We'd like to invite you to download the Sandy Adams mobile app. Our mobile app is available for iPhone, Android, and Windows smartphones. Or log on to sandyadams.org and simply click on the link from the main menu. When you download the app, you'll be able to listen to the most recent messages taught by Pastor Sandy, browse the series archive, and search the archive alphabetically. Finally, when you download the mobile app, you'll also have the opportunity to join us live for our Sunday morning worship service right from your smartphone. Again, to download the Sandy Adams mobile app, simply enter Sandy Adams in the search options of your smartphone's app store, or log on to sandyadams.org and simply click on the mobile app option right on the homepage. And please join us again as Pastor Sandy continues teaching through the Bible right here on Sandy Adams Radio.